An intellectual version of the gold rush began today at the Library of Congress when the library made public the files of the late Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. It is rare to get such insight into the court's inner workings, its personalities, and how decisions were made on controversies as diverse as the Watergate tapes, school prayer, or abortion.
Justice Blackmun served on the court for 24 years. He's best known to the public as the author of the Roe v. Wade abortion decision in 1973. National Public Radio is the only broadcast organization that has had advance access to the papers. For the last month, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has been poring over the files for a series of reports.
Harry Blackmun saved everything, even his dance cards from Harvard and the tennis scores from the boyhood matches he played with his friend Warren Burger, who would later become Chief Justice. In the end, Blackmun's files filled more than 1,576 boxes in the Library of Congress and contained 500,000 items. As if that were not enough, he did a 38-hour oral history with his former clerk, now Yale law professor Harold Coe. With great deliberation, and though he knew some of his colleagues would not like it, he decreed that everything be made public 5 years after his death.
There's a lot of history in these files as to how the court works and how these general principles are developed. My files are complete. I don't think we've destroyed anything.
As to the concerns of fellow justices that the files would compromise their privacy, Blackmun's one-time law clerk Bill McDaniel says that for Blackmun, that concern was secondary to the demands of history.
He certainly had a side to him that enjoyed puncturing pomposity, and I think to some extent he viewed the fetish the court had, especially some of the justices he served with, for secrecy as part of that pomposity.
The papers indeed show the justices, including Blackmun, as quite human. In the weekly secret conference one day, Blackmun scribbled a note to himself, "Talk about two clerks on crutches with ankle sprains while I sit here with a broken bone in my foot." On the bench another day, he's worried about Justice William Brennan, whose wife was ill, and he writes a note, "You have been very quiet today. Is everything all right?" Brennan replies, "I'm just bored. The previous argument was atrocious." Then there is this note from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. "Harry, I think your hearing aid is emitting a high-pitched noise. Can it be adjusted?" While the justices are hearing cases, the notes that circulate among them indicate that they sometimes quiz each other on their knowledge of sports, history, opera, and literature. They exchange the occasional bawdy rhyme and bet on baseball and elections. On October 10, 1973, at the height of the pennant race and with Vice President Spiro Agnew in legal trouble, this note came in from the clerks and was passed among the justices. "Vice President Agnew just resigned. Mets too. Reds nothing." There are more serious memos about the relations among the justices. The papers reveal for the first time that in 1975, after Justice William O. Douglas had a stroke and had started to resume his court work, a 7-justice majority voted not to release any 5-4 opinion in which Douglas was in the majority, and not to assign him any opinions. Justice Byron White wrote the Chief Justice a furious letter, quote, "registering my protest against a decision of the court made in the absence of Justice Douglas, without consulting doctors as to his competence or giving him a chance to respond." Noting that the Constitution provides only for impeachment of justices by Congress, White wrote, "It nowhere provides that a justice's colleagues may deprive him of his office by refusing to permit him to function as a justice. The court's action," said White, "perverts the constitutional design." Not long after White's letter, the question became moot, because Douglas decided to retire. The bulk of the Blackmun files, however, cover the serious business of judging and show the justices writing and rewriting opinions, struggling for the right words and the right meanings, and even changing their minds. In 1992, for instance, the papers show Justice Anthony Kennedy changed his vote in 2 pivotal cases, one involving school prayer, the other abortion. In the school prayer case, a Rhode Island student and her parents challenged the practice of school-sponsored prayer at graduation exercises. The Blackmun papers show that Justice Kennedy initially voted to uphold the practice and was assigned to write the opinion for a 5-justice majority. Blackmun, the senior justice in the minority, began drafting a dissent. But on March 30, 1992, Kennedy wrote to Blackmun that after drafting an opinion to uphold graduation prayer, quote, My draft looked quite wrong, so I have written it to rule in favor of the objecting student. 6 drafts later, Kennedy's opinion became law. Kennedy also became the central figure in the battle over Roe v. Wade and whether it would be, for all practical purposes, overruled. The year was 1992, and the Bush administration was pushing hard for the landmark abortion decision to be reversed. The conservative Clarence Thomas had just replaced the liberal Thurgood Marshall on the court, and as Justice Blackmun put it in a document in his files, the case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which presented the issue directly, was, quote, a brooding presence even before it got to the court, because we knew it was coming. At the justices' weekly conference after the case was argued, Blackmun recorded that 5 justices voted to uphold the Pennsylvania statute at issue in its entirety, meaning that significant roadblocks to abortion would be upheld for the first time. Justice Stevens is quoted as calling the 24-hour waiting period an insult to women, and the spousal notification provision outrageous. But he was in the minority. There were 5 votes to uphold the law: the Chief Justice and Justices White, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. But the Blackmun files reveal that Justice Kennedy, approached by Justices O'Connor and Souter, soon changed his mind and joined the 2 centrist justices to write an opinion that upheld a woman's fundamental right to abortion. The Chief Justice, apparently oblivious to the fact that his majority had fallen apart, circulated a so-called majority opinion on May 27th that, while not directly overruling Roe, would have left it a meaningless shell. 2 days later, Kennedy wrote Blackmun a note. I need to see you as soon as you have a few moments. I want to tell you about a new development in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It should come as welcome news. The 2 men met alone in the justice's library the next day. Blackmun would later say that it was a heart-to-heart conversation about what to expect in the aftermath of a decision that would be unpopular with many people. Certainly, Kennedy knew of the reaction to Roe, how Blackmun had borne the brunt of the criticism for the 7-2 decision he authored, the abuse he'd suffered, death threats, even a bullet through his living room window. And Kennedy, with no experience in such an emotional case, was concerned. As Justice Blackmun put it in his oral history,
it was not easy for Tony Kennedy to come on the court at this time. He was a Roman Catholic with strong views that meant a lot to him.
Even after the 2 justices talked, Blackmun was not sure Kennedy would stay on board.
He also informed the Chief Justice, who then spent some time in walks with Justice Kennedy to persuade him to change his mind.
But Rehnquist was unable to move Kennedy, and 4 days after Kennedy met with Blackmun, the group that came to be known inside the court as the Troika, Kennedy, O'Connor, and Souter, circulated the first of 5 drafts, reaffirming what they called the core holding of Roe. Justice Stevens immediately wrote to the 3, commending them on their work, and suggesting that with relatively minor changes, he could sign on to substantial parts of it. 2 weeks later, the Chief Justice was still trying to reconstitute his majority. He circulated a 2nd draft, still styled as a majority opinion. In it, Rehnquist contended that his opinion did not effectively overrule Roe, and he attacked the reasoning in the Troika opinion. The Troika, however, didn't budge. Indeed, at the suggestion of Justice Stevens, they moved around a 6 paragraphs unacceptable to Blackmun and Stevens, so that the 2 more liberal justices could join the first 3 sections of the opinion, making for a court majority. Blackmun, meanwhile, took steady aim at the Rehnquist contention that he was not trying to overrule Roe. Quote, the Chief Justice would have women sit shiva for Roe, wrote Blackmun in a never-published draft. All that remains is the unveiling of the headstone. On June 26th, the day before the opinions were ready to go to the printer, the Chief Justice circulated a 3rd draft, this time styled not as a majority opinion, but as a dissent, and admitting that he and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and White thought Roe was wrongly decided and should be overruled. Blackmun declared triumphantly, "The Chief Justice admits it. Gone are the contentions that the issue need not be considered." If the Chief Justice's views had become law, said Blackmun, states could have forbidden abortion for any reason except in cases where necessary to save the life of the mother. In a last paragraph of his new separate opinion, Blackmun, a Nixon appointee, warned that Roe still hung by a slender and political thread, a thread that very much depended on the outcome of the 1992 election. Justice Stevens tried to get him to drop the paragraph as too political. Blackmun clerks say that the justice spent an enormous amount of time considering that last paragraph, and in the end he did soften it a bit. Blackmun clerk Stephanie Dangles.
Justice Blackmun agreed that what Justices O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy had done was to try to put this decision above politics. But in the end, Justice Blackmun felt that he had become so personally associated with this issue for many women that he needed to speak candidly and regrettably admit that, you know, this issue is still not above politics, that the next election could change everything.
And so, Harry Blackmun declared on the last page of his concurrence that in one sense the majority and dissenting opinions were worlds apart, yet in another sense the distance between the two was just a single vote. Quote, "I am 83 years old," said Blackmun. "I cannot remain on this court forever, and when I do step down, the confirmation process for my successor well may focus on the issue before us today. That, I regret, may be exactly where the choice between the two worlds will be made." Indeed, the election of Bill Clinton meant that two Clinton appointees, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, joined the court, solidifying the majority in favor of Roe, at least for the time being. As Blackmun put it in his oral history,
"With the Casey case recently, finally, maybe, we've turned the corner on Roe against Wade, and it is accepted, and we're on to other issues."
The abortion cases, said Blackmun, stand as examples of the court's commitment to protecting individual rights from the tyranny of the majority.
"All this has been a bit of an experience for me personally. I never thought that I would be standing against the combined might of the Roman Catholic Church and the Mormon Church in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and other forces with all of their respected political power. It showed me once again that the federal bench is no place to win a popularity contest."
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
There are bench notes from the justices and video and audio of Justice Blackmun at our website, npr.org.